A new natural gas power plant seemed like a win for small-town officials. But some of their constituents had concerns.
They did nothing for us. They made fun of us. I mean, when I think of what they put us through, it's sickening.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, a town is divided over natural gas development. And President Trump wants to cut the red tape on building new infrastructure like bridges and highways.
We're going to get infrastructure built quickly, inexpensively, relatively speaking, and the permitting process will go very, very quickly.
But at what cost? Factoring climate change into the infrastructure equation. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. On Wednesday, a group of activists demanded Allegheny County health officials rein in air pollution from U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works, one of the biggest pollution sources in western Pennsylvania. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports the plant has had almost 7,000 violations in the past few years.
The plant's long record of violations drew a crowd of activists to a meeting at the Allegheny County Health Department, where they told the agency to clean the plant up. Many spoke about the impacts the Coke Works has on the Pittsburgh region's air quality. Clairton resident Melanie Mead said the plant impacts her own backyard. She said the soot she used to see deposited on her hometown has been cleaned up. But she said that doesn't mean the plant is safe.
It's not enough that we don't see the soot anymore. It's what we don't see that is hurting and harmful to the community.
She won't even let her 8-year-old son, Joseph, play football because the field where he would play faces the Coke plant.
The league makes the children play 5 days a week, practice 5 days a week. And that means that he would be practicing directly across the street from the Clairton Coke Works 5 days a week, rain, sleet, or snow. And I refuse to do that.
The Coke Works is the number three source of particle pollution in the state. And according to the EPA, it's paid over $2 million in fines from its air quality violations in the past 5 years. Allegheny County Health Department's Jim Kelly said one reason for so many violations is that his agency is keeping a close eye on it and recording violations as they come up.
Most facilities, we only have an inspector on site once or twice a year. We have inspectors on site every day, so they are finding violations.
Kelly said the department is working on a plan to bring the air quality in Clairton into federal compliance. Part of that plan is making U.S. Steel come up with a backup scenario in case its pollution controls are forced offline, a situation that happened this summer. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Clairton isn't the only community in our region where parents are worried about air pollution. East Liverpool, Ohio, is about 40 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. Like a lot of Rust Belt towns, it's economically depressed. People there have relied on heavy industry for decades, many industries that are still in operation. Environmental activists have been fighting a hazardous waste incinerator there since the 1990s. But a new environmental health study of elementary school students living in East Liverpool brought a few dozen parents and residents to a meeting there recently. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's Don Hopi was there and joins me now to talk about it. Don, what did the study find?
Well, the study by the University of Cincinnati researchers found that lower IQ was positively correlated to exposure to manganese in the air.
I understand that the East Liverpool School District superintendent asked for the study. Why did he do that?
It was the previous East Liverpool superintendent because, A, the measurements of high manganese in the air had been going on since 1999. They were aware of that problem, that issue. And also, the students in the school district, they had a higher percentage of special education students in East Liverpool School District, 19%, higher than the state average, which was 13% per school district.
So say a little bit about manganese. What is it? What's it used for?
Sure. Manganese is a naturally occurring element. It's in rocks and soil and food. It's used in steel making. It's used in batteries. And it's really necessary for the development of childhood brains. You have to have manganese for proper brain development. The problem comes when there's too much manganese in the environment that children are in. And that was what apparently has happened here.
You reported that the author of the study was very careful to say that the source of the manganese in the air was not part of the study, that they were just looking at the levels of manganese in the children's blood and hair and the correlation with IQ. But there is a business in East Liverpool, Ohio, that processes and handles manganese as part of its business. And it's been a long time issue there in East Liverpool, and that's the S.H. Bell Company.
Yeah, the researcher was very careful not to name a source. The study did not identify sources or anything like that. East Liverpool is a small town along the Ohio River that has a long history of industrial development, and they have multiple sources of manganese emissions in the town even today. But the Ohio EPA has identified S.H. Bell as a primary, or actually the primary, source of airborne manganese in the town. Ohio EPA and the U.S. EPA have entered into consent agreements that have caused S.H. Bell to change their work procedures at their warehousing facility. And that has resulted in a reduction in manganese emissions from that facility. They no longer store, for example, manganese containing materials outside on open pads next to the river where winds can pick it up and blow it into town.
You mentioned the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency. You know, in 2010, they listed manganese concentrations in East Liverpool up to 30 times higher than the EPA safe guideline. So why haven't they been able to do, why haven't they and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency been able to do more to reduce manganese in the air in East Liverpool?
Well, there are two reasons. As I said before, there are a lot of different sources of manganese. This is a primary source, but there are other sources, including the world's largest hazardous, commercial hazardous waste incinerator. The second reason is that these, as you said, are guidelines. These are safe guidelines. Manganese is not one of the EPA's six criteria pollutants. And as such, while they know that a lot of it can cause damage, it's not something that the EPA has set hard and fast limits on. So the guidelines are there, and the agencies know that higher levels than the guidelines could cause problems, but they're not hard and fast limits. And so that causes some issues in terms of pursuing remedies.
We've heard a lot about the impacts of lead on kids recently because of Flint and all of the other cities that are having issues with water and infrastructure. What are the long-term effects of manganese? I mean, we're talking about IQ. I'm imagining that's not reversible.
Right. The effects of high levels of manganese can damage learning capabilities in children, can cause memory loss, can cause kind of a slowness. And also, and this is exhibited by people who mine manganese, it's a Parkinson's-like tremors that the people can get. Other studies that have been conducted in Ohio around manganese smelters in Marietta, Ohio. There's also a manganese smelter in Chicago, Illinois. And in both of those places, some studies have determined that folks that live closer to the manganese smelters do exhibit some increased tremors and some memory issues.
There were about 100 kids in this study. I think they were elementary school age. Was there any talk at the meeting about how the study could be used to improve things there in East Liverpool for these kids or kids who are living there?
Well, the study's main author did meet with a school superintendent and some other school officials this past Tuesday to talk about the results and what might be next step. This coming spring, the study participants, the 100 or so students, they're going to get as many of those kids as possible and bring them to Pittsburgh for MRIs that will be done at Children's Hospital. And the federal agencies would like to see the follow-up studies to see exactly what kind of problems are persisting in the students now that they're beyond in their teen years. So they're trying to track it that way. So again, there's some things happening, but it's going to take a while.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Don Hopi covers the environment for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. There's more about his story at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Natural disasters like hurricanes almost always mean destruction and, tragically, some loss of life. But would Harvey, Irma, and Maria have been different if we'd planned better?
There are people who died that didn't need to die. And there are people who've died since the storm hit who didn't need to die.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, a call to build infrastructure like our sewers and bridges to withstand a changing climate. Stay tuned. The nation's natural gas drilling boom has ushered in major changes in how the U.S. produces electricity. In Pennsylvania alone, energy firms have proposed more than 40 gas-fired projects since 2011. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has teamed up with the Center for Public Integrity to take a closer look at how the largest of these, known as the Lackawanna Energy Center, has split the tiny community of Jessup.
The plant construction site about 10 miles northeast of Scranton looms over the region that's known as the Mid-Valley. It sparked a bitter fight for political power in what was once a close-knit community.
Look right out my front door. We were told we weren't going to see that. Okay? My eyesight isn't that good. And could you see that?
The plant is easy to see from Terry Caparo's house. She's furious it spoils her view of the mountainside, but is even more upset with the way the Jessup Borough Council seemed to welcome it with open arms. Whether it was zoning issues or concerns about pollution and property values, she feels like her elected officials ignored people at every turn.
They did nothing for us. They made fun of us. I mean, when I think of what they put us through, for a year and a half, it's sickening.
That feeling has sparked a wave of political activism. Peter Larioni is part of a group of nearly 60 people opposed to the plant known as Citizens for a Healthy Jessup.
You know Pete Larioni, don't you?
They've taken on the Borough Council and Invenergy, the Chicago-based company building the power plant.
It seems like everything Invenergy wants, they get. And we just can't understand it.
Larioni was among a group of candidates who defeated three pro-plant incumbents on the council during the May primary.
The Jessup Borough did what they had to do under the law. We couldn't. People want us to say, just tell them, go to hell. Walk away from this. No, we can't.
Jessup Borough Solicitor Richard Finucci says he's considering stepping down, claiming he was personally maligned over his work negotiating with Invenergy over the power plant. He says no matter which way the election goes, he'll rest easy knowing he helped negotiate what's known as a host agreement with Invenergy. The deal means the company will pay more than $1 million a year to Jessup for the 40-year life of the plant.
Now the easy part comes. Now it's about they have all this money that no other municipality in the entire state of Pennsylvania will have. No one. We're the only ones. A little town of 5,000 people getting all this money. It's incredible.
That's a lot of money for a community with a $2.2 million annual budget. Finucci's critics say he's a small-town attorney who lacked the expertise to negotiate a fair deal. They feel the borough should have gotten more out of this once-in-a-lifetime windfall. Candidate Peter Larioni says the council rejected efforts by his group to bring in an outside legal team.
Right from the beginning, when you had all these meetings, all these battles, we never won a battle. And it was always Finucci directing everywhere, where to go here, where to go there. He was almost, the last meeting, couple meetings, he was taking over to council meetings. It was ridiculous.
As head of the Pennsylvania Economy League Central Pennsylvania Division, Gerald Cross has worked with a lot of local governments in financial distress. He says sometimes elected officials lack the expertise to negotiate such big projects, but he sees a bigger problem.
I think more often than not, what hurts the local government and the officials is they tend to see local economic development projects as somehow a savior for their municipal budget.
Savior or not, the plant has already brought benefits. It's provided more than 1,000 construction jobs for the region and will eventually have 30 permanent employees. Dan Ewan, Invenergy's vice president of thermal development, says the project will be a net positive for Jessup.
We feel like we've listened to the community. We've made some changes to the project as a result of community input. And while there might be a small group of people that oppose the project, we feel like generally the community has been welcoming.
Across the country, natural gas has been rapidly displacing coal, a much dirtier fossil fuel, as a key fuel for generating electricity. And renewables are on the rise, too. Invenergy is a major player in renewables. A lot of its new projects are in wind. But Ewan says this new gas power plant is also part of the company's broader commitment to clean energy.
And clean energy means wind, solar. We believe it's natural gas. Natural gas is used to support all of our efforts in the wind and the solar business. It's a bridge fuel.
But as energy firms race to build billions of dollars worth of new gas infrastructure, everything from wells to pipelines and power plants, it's creating controversy and dividing communities. Roberto Galati is another candidate running alongside Larioni. She says their group wants to spend the annual payments of $1 million in a way that will most benefit Jessup's citizens.
None of us, first of all, were politicians.
They also want to improve transparency in local government, balance the needs of citizens and businesses when it comes to zoning, and she also feels the borough had routinely ignored people's concerns about the power plant.
The more we got to see how badly we were being treated was when we decided to run.
They're now gearing up for next week's general election, knocking on doors, while hoping to capture a majority by taking over 4 of the 7 council seats.
Hello.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Joe, how are you?
Joe Munley can see and hear the power plant construction site from his house. He plans to move out of the community soon, but not until after he casts a vote for the power plant opponents.
Well, I feel good with the new plan that's going to come in, because I know all these people, and they're going to do what's right for the town.
This was a battle, and I think the battle with the election was all over the power plant. Even though it shouldn't have been, it was.
One of the council incumbents who lost her primary race amid the anti-power plant fervor is Maggie Aluni.
I don't fault anybody for having an opinion against it, and I hope they wouldn't fault me for having an opinion for it. But I just want Jessup to heal.
Whether the community heals or not, the plant is here to stay. Construction is nearly complete, and it's expected to come online next year. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania, Lackawanna County.
Houston, the Florida Keys, and of course Puerto Rico are going to be recovering from the storms that ravaged them for decades. And as Congress pays out more than $36 billion in disaster relief, the General Accounting Office is recommending that the government find ways to minimize the economic impacts of climate change, like superstorms and wildfires. A couple of years ago, President Obama started moving in that direction. He signed an executive order requiring infrastructure like roads and bridges be designed to survive flooding and other consequences of climate change. But President Trump issued an executive order that pretty much undid that.
We're going to get infrastructure built quickly, inexpensively, relatively speaking, and the permitting process will go very, very quickly.
Daniel Krieger has an opinion about this. He's executive director of the Association of Climate Change Officers, which helps businesses, industry, and professionals plan for climate change. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke with him for our Trump on Earth podcast. Krieger says we design infrastructure based on the weather we've had over the last century.
Those designs can be sewers and stormwater. They can be buildings and the built environment. They could be natural systems like our farming practices.
But the weather, because of global warming, is changing.
The rules of the game are changing on us as our own fault. And now we have to figure out how are we going to play in this new world that we've created. What we've seen with these three hurricanes is a perfect example. If you look at Harvey and the 50 inches of rain, The question we should be asking is, why did 50 inches of rain turn into 10, 15, and 20 feet of flood in certain parts of Houston, particularly when there were reports from multiple agencies at different levels of government that said, we have a design problem here, and we're creating a basin. When a bad enough set of rainfall comes, we're going to have a problem. 50 inches of rain did not need to translate into 20 feet of flood in neighborhoods in Houston. And yet, because we didn't have the right policy mandating either new design or an overhaul of existing design to address that issue, we had an infrastructure failure.
What did President Obama's order, the one that said climate change needed to be considered in building new infrastructure, you know, how did that kind of infiltrate and affect everything that folks that you talk with, in you know, people who are involved in the actual design, building, construction of these projects? Was this sort of an opening to say, okay, now we can start really thinking about what is a real storm going to start looking like here? What do we need to be prepared for culverts, for waterways, for bridges, for what, you know, however, whatever the project may be in a given community?
You think about federal agencies like FEMA or HUD, who put copious amounts of federal dollars out to either help prevent disasters or as a result of disasters. And those dollars now were starting to be doled out intelligently, either to make sure that the projects they were being doled at were accounting for climate risk in their design, or alternatively, FEMA at one point had issued a mandate that local and state governments who are submitting their hazard mitigation plans, which they're required to do to FEMA to be eligible for FEMA funding, had to account for climate change in those plans. Then you also had the operations of the federal government. So when you're talking about military installations and national parks and monuments and other federal lands, whether it's highways and such, you were starting to see this move into planning going forward and the federal government's influence to change those behavior. And the hope was that if you could institutionalize this enough in the federal government, that you could change the practices taking place at all levels. Well, unfortunately, we didn't have enough time of that being the case. And of course, the current administration came in and is in effect really just pretty much wiping out anything that had President Obama's fingerprint on it. But the irony of it is that those three storms coming have now put them under a microscope. And Congress, even a Congress that has failed to act effectively on this issue in any way, shape, or form, frankly, is now going to have to focus very intently because it's writing the check. And it doesn't want to write the check. This particular Congress really, really doesn't want to write big checks, right? And now all of a sudden, they're sitting with three storms that each of which has tens, if not more, of billions of dollars that they have to write checks for, much less the damage was substantially more so. And you know, you had the fourth largest city in the country. You had a state with the fourth largest economy in the country. And then you have Puerto Rico with 3.5 to 4 million people, all of them compromised at the same time. Congress is not equipped to write $200 billion in checks like this on a regular basis.
At a press conference in late August, President Trump said it took, in one state, 17 years to get all the permits needed to build a highway. He did not list what state that was.
This is what it takes to get something approved today. Elaine, you see that? So this is what it takes. Permitting process flowchart. That's a flowchart. So that can go out to 20 years. This shows about 10. But that could go out to about 20 years to get something approved. This is for a highway. I've seen a highway recently in a certain state. I won't mention its name. It's 17 years. I could have built it for $4 or $5 million without the permitting process. It cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but it took 17 years to get it approved and many, 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 many pages of environmental impact studies. This is what we will bring it down to. This is less than 2 years. This is going to happen quickly. That's what I'm signing today. This will be less than 2 years for a highway.
Does he have a point there? You know, did these kinds of things really happen? And now with his order revoking President Obama's climate order on infrastructure, Trump is saying it's going to take only 2 years to get approvals for something like a highway. Can we really create or build infrastructure that's resilient if we don't have this oversight by the federal government and this requirement that climate change is considered in the building of infrastructure?
He's not wrong when he says that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. He is wrong when he oversimplifies addressing it by just saying, well, we're just going to rip it all out. Because on the flip side, if we put the money into the project and do it wrong, it's going to fail. And so there needs to be a happy medium here. We need to make sure that when we're spending dollars on infrastructure, we're spending them intelligently. We need to make sure that that process is reasonable. And then unfortunately, these systems are really complicated. The question is, how do we develop a process that intelligently addresses what those rightful intersections are while making sure that that process doesn't take decades? And climate change now is happening so dynamically and so quick, it's accelerating, that we actually are going to have to redesign how big urban centers function in particular over the next 50 years, soup to nuts. Well, it takes 50 years to build a city or to rebuild a city and re-envision it, especially if it's been overdeveloped. At some point or another, we're going to have to get our arms around how do we balance being more efficient with these processes with making sure we've done our due diligence and having intelligent design in there.
Yeah, I mean, is there some danger here if infrastructure does not consider the changes that are coming in the climate? You know, what are the concerns for loss of life, for loss of tax money in the investments that we're making into infrastructure?
Yeah, let me be clear about this, because I made these comments earlier in the context of sensible investment of dollars. The issue here is not just a dollar investment. This is a very serious issue for the public health. There are lives on the line. And you've seen it in these storms, right? Harvey, there are people who died that didn't need to die. There are people in Puerto Rico who died who didn't need to die. And there are people who've died since the storm hit who didn't need to die. The mental health impacts on people after these events is staggering. And we're just starting to see the science start to really clarify what we're dealing with. And then you're going to have issues with food security, and you're going to have issues with other forms of security. So when these systems fail, you're going to be talking about a complete change of what our civilization as a country looks like. That's going to be catastrophic to some communities more so than others, but the ripple effect is going to be massive. And the longer we go without getting smart about this, the worse it's going to get. I don't want to paint a sky is falling on this, but a lack of action is going to create a sky is falling impact on us.
Daniel Krieger is executive director of the Association of Climate Change Officers. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant by Skype for our Trump on Earth podcast. There's more of that conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org. Trump on Earth is a co-production with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. That's TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of The Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.